Thank you for having me back. Now let's begin. Today's reading was described rather nicely by Chesterton as when shepherds came to the shepherd. You know it well, I'm sure, and the linking episodes following Luke's account of John the Baptist's birth and of Gabriel's announcing to Mary that she was to have a child. Here we have angels alerting men to recognize a particular baby as Messiah and Savior, inaugurating a new age of God's goodwill towards us. In fact, thanks to festivals of nine lessons and to paraphrases in popular carols, you probably know the passage virtually by heart. Very likely you know, too, the corresponding passages in Matthew, where the infant Jesus is visited by star-led magi bringing gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. So we're well placed, I think, to scrutinize together both those birth narratives, as the theologians call them. That's what I want to do. My reason, however, is rather shameful. It's because too many people are skeptical about them, patronizingly, unwisely, supposing sometimes that they're fit only for children. Mind you, I admit the narratives pose several very obvious problems, but if those are faced, I'm confident that we discover the difficulties are more apparent than real. Unfortunately, it means I'm going to be dry and argumentative, even more than I usually am. Really, I would prefer to be speaking positively about the incarnation, but when surveys suggest that 30% of English vicars have reservations about the virgin birth, you'll appreciate there is a need to address such doubts. Not that defending the biblical story means defending the way it's nowadays celebrated. The current commercialization of Christmas isn't entirely secular, but obviously it's some way removed from the original Christian core. Santa Claus, supposedly resident at the North Pole, aided by elves, transported by reindeer, slithering down chimneys, presents, stockings, trees, tinsel, baubles, wreaths, cards, vastly elaborated meals. None of those, except for gifts and presents, could I find in a New Testament Greek lexicon. And at the risk of seeming to say, bah, humbug, we really should remind ourselves that all those features are inessentials and potentially distracting. They may be delightful to many, but they're actually a serious strain on many others. Nevertheless, people do continue to be drawn to Christmas, in numbers suggesting that they're drawn by something deeper than nostalgia. Nor will I defend, nor need I, since it's not in the biblical accounts, the conventional dating. Dionysius Exiguus was a 6th century Byzantine monk who saw Jesus' birth as history's great watershed. Consequently, he split time asunder, separating the years since our Lord, AD, from those before Christ, BC. Both the idea and the insight behind it were entirely laudable. It's only unfortunate that his calculations weren't. AD 1 certainly wasn't when Jesus was born, as we'll see. As for the day, it was surprisingly long before Jesus' nativity had its own place in the Christian calendar. In the 3rd century, it was celebrated jointly with his baptism, usually on January the 6th. Not till the 4th century did it feature on its own, first in Rome and maybe North Africa around 350, in Constantinople 25 years later. It became widespread only in the 5th century and then grew in importance and scale once the Emperor Justinian made it in the 6th century a public holiday. The actual day, 25th of December, was first proposed as a suitable one for the feast by Hippolytus of Rome in the early 3rd century. Though, as I've just said, it took quite a while to catch on. He felt March the 25th, the spring equinox, was an appropriate occasion for Gabriel to have told Mary that she was going to have a child. And therefore, he suggested that the birth be celebrated 9 months later. Is it a coincidence that that's the same time as Saturnalia, the pagan winter solstice, held on what was, in the old Julian calendar, the shortest day of the year? The coincidence has given rise to skeptics complaining that Christmas appropriated the old pagan festival. It's true, at least insofar as both festivals mark the start of increasing light, but notice, please, the differences. Saturnalia was only about daylight. Christmas is about all light, especially spiritual light, the light of the world, the light of the world living a human life. Christmas eclipses the earlier rite by including all that that had meant and far, far more besides. Christmas is the earlier thing expanded, no longer one-dimensional, but transformed into two, three, and more dimensions. If that's appropriation, you know, it's entirely appropriate. And that pattern, that dimensional expansion, we'll see again later. However symbolically apt it may be, I doubt 25th of December was really when Jesus was born. Shepherds out at night with their flocks isn't very plausible so late in the year. But there is a way, or so Messianic Jews I know tell me, there is a way to get an approximate idea when it happened. John the Baptist's father, you'll remember, Zechariah, belonged to the division of Abijah, 8th of the 24 groups of minor priests, from whom individuals were chosen by lot for the privilege of burning incense for a week once a year in the temple. Abijah's turn came during the second Sabbath of the month Sivan, and Zechariah's wife Elizabeth became pregnant with John shortly thereafter. Consequently, John would have been born on or around the 15th of the month Nisan, which happens to be Passover. Jesus, according to Luke, was 6 months younger, conceived therefore on or around the 25th of the month Kislev, which happens to be Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights, commemorating the dedication of the Second Temple. And so, he must have been born on or around the full moon on the 15th of the month Tishri, which happens to be Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. Wouldn't it be evocative if we could make those connections precisely? The Baptist with Passover, Jesus with Hanukkah and Tabernacles. Tantalizingly, though, we can't get any closer than on or around. At least our best guess puts Jesus' birth in the late summer-autumn period, more historically plausible, if less poetic than Christina Rossetti's carol in the bleak midwinter. Though, come to think of it, there may be some sort of poetry in realizing that the remedy for the fall came in the fall. Anyway, from justified skepticism about the 25th of December, AD 1, let's now list why exactly people are skeptical about the birth narratives themselves. First of all, we've two accounts, widely different. Luke's is written from Mary's perspective, has people guided by angels, the action begins in Nazareth, moves to Bethlehem, with shepherds visiting, then briefly to Jerusalem and back to Nazareth. Matthew's is written from Joseph's perspective, has people guided in dreams. The action begins in Bethlehem with Magi visiting, before the Holy Family flee from Herod by going to Egypt and finally, after Herod's death, settling in Nazareth. Reconciling the logistics isn't too hard. Children's nativity plays do manage it. However, there are three substantial problems. First problem, Herod, the great threat in Matthew's story, died, we now know, even if Dionysius Exiguus didn't, in 4 BC. Yet Luke says Jesus was born when Quirinius was governor of Syria, a post he only took up in 6 AD. Consequently, the Bible's two birth narratives are at least a decade apart. Second problem. Matthew and Luke both supply genealogies for Jesus, but the list of names, from King David down to Joseph, are completely incompatible. Also, while Joseph could have adopted Jesus legally, he couldn't transmit a bloodline. Consequently, Christianity must forego one of its traditional claims, either Jesus' virgin birth or his Davidic descent must be relinquished. Third problem. The New Testament stories echo so very closely Old Testament episodes. Matthew's Jesus is just like Moses, almost killed at birth, while other Jewish baby boys are, by a bad king, and having hurriedly to quit the country. And Luke's Mary is just like Isaac's mother Sarah or Samuel's mother Hannah, a woman conceiving when that seems impossible. Moreover, Mary goes on to celebrate her pregnancy in a song, familiar to us as the Magnificat, where sentiment after sentiment duplicates what Hannah had said centuries before. Consequently, the birth narratives look derived, look unoriginal in content and language. They look like their copies. Let's be honest, those are quite substantial difficulties, and they certainly require answering. On dating, first of all the evidence points to the Herod dating prior to 4 BC, rather than Quirinius in 6 AD or later. For one thing, Herod is fundamental to Matthew's plotline, whereas Quirinius is relatively inessential to Luke's. Additionally, we know that the strict Jewish sect, the Essenes, fled to Egypt to escape from Herod, returning only after his death, in the same way that Matthew says the Holy Family did. Admittedly, Herod's slaying baby boys in Bethlehem, the massacre of the innocents, as Christians call it, isn't explicitly confirmed by the Jewish historian Josephus. But Josephus does mention many other atrocities, including similarly motivated murders. Herod had his favorite wife, Mariamne, killed, and then, in 7 BC, two of her sons as well, all because she was a Hasmonean princess, a descendant of the Maccabees, and had a better, a more authentically Jewish claim to the throne than he had. And Julius Africanus tells us that Herod had all the public genealogical records destroyed to try to undermine any other potential claimants. It's worth noticing, too, what astronomers have come up with when they tried to identify the Magi's star. Han Dynasty Chinese records mention a nova, an exploding star, visible for 70 nights in 5 BC. Or maybe Kepler was correct to suggest that it was a striking conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter in the constellation of Pisces, something he calculated had been visible in 7 BC. He even found rabbinical references saying that just such an event would mark Messiah's birth. All those points support a Herod dating rather than Quirinius. And most telling of all, even Luke points to Herod's dating. For he says that Jesus began his public ministry aged about 30 in the 15th year of the Emperor Tiberius. That's 28 AD. So Luke must have realized Jesus was born a few years BC, must have realized it was several years earlier than Quirinius's 6 AD census. And Luke certainly knew about the 6 AD census because he refers to it in the book of Acts, to an abortive revolt led by Judas the Galilean, which that census provoked. Consequently, it's odd. It's very odd that Luke aligns Jesus' birth with the first census when Quirinius was governor of Syria. In Egypt, a Roman census was held regularly, every 14 years. But I'm unaware of any subsequent one in Israel after the one that triggered Judas's revolt. So why does Luke say first census? Or did he say that? It's been argued that actually we're misled by an ambiguity in translation, that the word prote, commonly rendered first, should in this case be prior or previous to, in which case the questions about Quirinius are really just a mare's nest. All Luke is saying is that Jesus' birth was before Quirinius' census, and that's just what we'd expect, given that Luke was well aware Jesus was too old to have been born then. The apparent discrepancy of a decade disappears when we look a little more closely. Turning to the genealogies, Matthew's has curious features. There's a pattern. From Abraham to King David, 14 generations. From David through Solomon down to Jeconiah, the last king of Judah and deported to Babylon, 14 generations. Then from that exile to Joseph, described as the husband of Mary, the mother of Jesus, called the Christ, 13 generations. Why one short? Perhaps it's only when Jesus is accepted and called Christ or is known as risen Lord that the symmetry of Old Testament promises is completed. Incidentally, Jeconiah's presence in that genealogy is disquieting. You may know that the prophet Jeremiah cursed Jeconiah's line, declaring it would not produce the Messiah. Matthew's genealogy, despite being Davidic, cannot be messianic. Surprisingly too, Matthew mentions women, four: Rahab, Tamar, Ruth, Bathsheba, all tainted, either because they were morally reproachable or else foreign. The point, presumably, is symbolic, that even if Mary's unaccountable premature pregnancy looks wrong, God had previously worked his purposes through other women, compromised in their different ways. And when we compare Matthew's genealogy with Luke's, straight away the problem is obvious. Matthew says Joseph's father was Jacob. Luke's genealogy begins, Jesus, supposed son of Joseph, of Heli, of Matat, and so on. So who is this Heli? Mary's parents were Anna and Joachim. Now, Jo and Eli are Hebrew prefixes both referring to God. So Joachim and Helikim, or Heli in its abbreviated familiar form, are in fact equivalent names. Once we realize that, we see that Luke's genealogy, like the rest of his birth narrative, is from Mary's perspective. It isn't Joseph's genealogy, it's hers. Even if her name, as would normally be the case in Jewish genealogies, was omitted. Moreover, Luke takes Heli's line back to David, not through Solomon and the discredited Jeconiah, but through another of David's sons, Nathan. Thus, the genealogical problems are resolved. The apparent discrepancies stem from Matthew's family tree being Joseph's, while Luke's family tree is Mary's. And although Jesus himself put little or no weight on Davidic descent, he had it on both sides, legally through Joseph, and more important, genetically through his mother, in a line that was both Davidic and potentially messianic. Let's turn to the last of the three big problems, the birth narrative's unoriginality. Personally, I find it reassuring. It suggests the same God at work in the Old Testament and in Jesus' birth. Or it would be reassuring if we can be confident that Matthew and Luke's stories aren't inventions. The reason I'm certain they're not inventions is that at one and the same time, they're unoriginal and, once we notice it, staggeringly original as well. The derived patterns are given the boldest twists, twists too radical to imagine Matthew or Luke independently making them up. Yes, Matthew's Jesus does echo Moses. But Pharaoh is now a Jewish king, and Egypt is the safe haven when escaping away from the promised land. Whereas magicians contended against Moses, now foreign and pagan sages pay homage to Jesus. There's a great twist, even in the symbolism of the gifts the Magi bring. Kingship, priesthood, and death. They're hardly original themes, but bringing them together, conjoined in one and the same person, that's an unprecedented twist. Even Moses' law is referred to and reversed. For Joseph, remember, was a just man, a righteous man, a lawkeeper, a tzaddik, they might say nowadays. Yet, he rejects the option that the law gave him to divorce Mary. Incidentally, as an aside on the word divorce, you probably know that these terms were very elastic in the first century. A woman would get betrothed to a man for a year before they got married. But in that period, she could be referred to as a wife. Moreover, if the engagement broke up, it could be called a divorce. Even words like virgin actually had a rather elastic meaning. Philo of Alexandria would call a woman too old to have children a virgin. But we know how it's meant in the case of Mary. A woman engaged, but not yet married. A woman sexually a virgin. But let's go on. Even when Matthew quotes the Old Testament, it's because the older events are being transcended, not duplicated. Yes, Isaiah had prophesied God would rescue King Ahaz from a threat by the time a local girl came to motherhood. What Matthew records is both the same and infinitely more. A virgin who will conceive and bear a son whose work shall call us, whose work shall make us say, Emmanuel, God with us. It's a dimensional expansion again of what Isaiah had meant. Similarly, of course, Luke's Mary does echo Hannah's words. It's quite natural, she should. A pious girl in a situation, what else would she do except echo the words of someone in a more or less similar situation in her old Hebrew Bibles. But similar sentiments mustn't blind us to how radical the twist is, how dissimilar their situations are. One, a previously barren woman, finally having, by the normal process, the baby that she was trying for. The other, a girl quite capable of having a child, except that she had not known a man. A girl who then conceives supernaturally. The parallels that skeptics point to are there, all right, but they aren't the whole story. As with Saturnalia, wholly unexpected new dimensions are there as well. Even if you imagine that Matthew and Luke could both independently have made all that up, we have to ask, why would they? The fact is, and I'll be ending shortly by explaining the significance of this. The fact is, the virgin birth, biggest of those twists, wasn't part of the preaching package used by the early church to attract people and to convince them to convert. Matthew and Luke open their Gospels with it and then make no further reference to it. The Gospels of Mark and John never refer to it. Neither St. Paul nor any of the other writers of the epistles do. Not even the epistles by James and Jude, and they were Jesus' brothers. The early church certainly believed in the virgin birth. There's ample evidence of that. But they didn't use it. Evidently, it wasn't strictly necessary to the Christian message, the core message. So why would Matthew and Luke put it in, except because it was true? In her book, Alone of All Her Kind, Mary Warner got rather a reputation for being an expert on Mary a few years ago. In it, she tried to give the answer that skeptics offer. The Christian religion, I'm quoting her, the Christian religion's use of the virgin birth as the key to the argument that Jesus was the Son of God was classical in spirit. Really? We've just seen that actually the New Testament never uses the virgin birth as the basis for any argument. Jesus is recognized to be Son of God on quite other grounds. And the virgin birth certainly wasn't classical, nor would it have appealed to potential converts from classical backgrounds. I guess that Marina Warner imagines that it parallels myths of Heracles or Dionysius and so on. But how exactly? Those were unhistorical demigods, fathered on human women by deities in various physical guises. They were hybrids born to accomplish some heroic feat so as to earn for themselves, if successful, like Heracles, a very minor place amongst a host of other Olympian deities. The more closely you consider that description, the less any parallel with Jesus can be discerned. Above all, what Warner and her ilk fail to take seriously is something Christians have always stressed, that, as the second century apologist Justin Martyr put it, Mary remained a virgin after the Annunciation. Now that is utterly unclassical in spirit. No myth ever dreamed of that. Yet once we're told it, doesn't it ring true? Uniquely in the biblical story, conspicuous by its absence there, there was no physical act. God didn't play some physical role to affect ordinary intercourse and produce a child, as in dozens of myths from around the world. Rather, God acted directly, as only the true God can. Philosophically, there's no difficulty with that, no inconsistency in a creator entering his creation directly. Yet some skeptics, especially a skeptical clergy, see a theological difficulty. They say that if Christ, the second Adam, is to save us, children of the first Adam, then surely it's necessary for Christ to have been born in the same way, therefore not to have been born by a supernatural conception. Now, that sounds quite a powerful argument. But the answer is simply to remember we trace ourselves back to the first Adam, and he didn't have a human father either. Even if, as I personally suspect, God created Adam through a process of evolution, the first human's progenitors weren't human. Jesus' birth was supernatural, but so too was Adam's and, albeit a way down the line, ours too, just as our rebirth needs to be supernatural. I hope I've done something to answer the doubts about the birth narratives, but I must end by giving a warning of my own about Bethlehem. It's not enough. The story, which begins in a cave, for in all likelihood that's what the stable was, goes on into another cave, one previously unused and which, after it was used, was found to be empty. The early church made Bethlehem no part of its public preaching because it knew not only where but why Jesus was born. As Saviour, so angels inform the shepherds. At the forefront of the church's message, therefore, has to be not the start but the climax of the story. Jesus' crucifixion, resurrection, and ascended glory. The Creed says, for us and for our salvation he came down to earth. And the Athanasian Creed explains a little further that that salvation consists not in God coming down to man, but in Jesus raising men up to God. That Jesus is not only the shepherd to whom shepherds came, he is the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep.